Hello, everybody. Michael C. Rupert, Tracker Truth, with you on Sunday, the 12th of January, 2014. Looks like we made it another week. Woohoo. The weather here has been amazing here at the nightclub at the end of the world. We've had sustained winds of about 40 miles an hour most of the day, gusts to 60, a little bit better. I've never seen wind like this in my life, and our driveway is 400 yards now to the road is all filled in with drifts, new drifts. So, yeah, weather is humbling, but we know that around the world, don't we? As we go live tonight on the air, Infinite Growth is still rapidly, infinitely trying to grow. All the carbon-emitting industries, human industrial civilization, are still pumping out more and more and more carbon, asymptotically or exponentially, every day. Fukushima nuclear power is still out of control. Chris Busby has a great new video and interview out with Voice of Russia. I encourage you to watch it. It's on my Facebook page. Thank God for Chris Busby. Fukushima is out of control. It is deteriorating. It is worsening. And, quote, it cannot be controlled. We knew that. And there's about 450 other nuclear reactors and waste dump facilities that are leaking. We know that story. And as I look tonight, as we come into the show tonight, I look at world meters. World population at the moment is loading on my page. 7,205,953,000,000, counting faster than I can count. 302,303,000 new births today, 124,000 deaths, net population growth, 177,000. And it's still got a few hours to go. We're adding a quarter of a million people a day net, 200 species a day going extinct. And so here we are. Nothing has changed from my criterion. However, except in West Virginia, my mother was born and raised in Clay County in St. Albans, West Virginia. And I remember up until I was about 7, 8 years old, spending some amazing times in West Virginia visiting my aunt and my grandma. And my Uncle Charlie worked for Union Carbide. He died of cancer, 44 years of age, of course, lived there in West Virginia. So I know the area, and there has been a major leak of a chemical called 4-methylcyclohexane methanol. God, that sounds horrible, and it is, into the water supply, denying people in 9 counties, 300,000 souls, the ability to brush their teeth, wash their hands, take a shower, because there is the symptoms when you get exposed to this, and a number of people have been, are severe burning in throat, severe eye irritation, nonstop vomiting, trouble breathing, or severe skin irritation such as skin blistering. This is nasty, nasty shit. Water trucks have been escorted. They call the police and the guard to stop looting because people are thirsty. And police and military have been escorting water trucks, and this is collapse. This is heartbreaking. And it even, you know, is kind of over and above, but this is part of the infrastructure story of collapse that I told in the movie and that I told, throughout my, in Crossing the Rubicon. This is what collapse and confronting collapse, my second book, this is what it looks like. And this compounds the other problems that we have even more. I had a dream this week, and we are going to have... I hope we're going to have, let me see if we have Paul standing by. I want to make sure, check with the board, see if we do. I've got a couple more things to say. I had a dream this week. Still no, okay, getting busy signals. Okay, now I got to get back to, all right, we are trying to connect with Paul Beckwith, who was our guest tonight, and they're getting busy signals from the board in New York. Let me continue here. She's still trying to get through. I had a dream this week. You know, people have asked me a lot. Hold on one second. I want to make a note to the board here. So they have his emergency cell phone number, and Paul also has the 800 number into the board. So I just want to make sure that we get that. We all getting busy signals there, too. All circuits are busy. Paul Beckwith, if you can hear this, the board is trying to call you and is unable to do so because busy signals, rapid busies on both landlines and everything else. Hold on a second, everybody. Stand by. I'm just going to type a live message in now. Board can't. This is live radio, baby. All right, I'm making a note here. I'm telling Paul Beckwith. Oops. All right. All right, so I'm sending that to Paul. So I've notified Paul. All right, we will get him on the line. So I want to go back to had a dream. A lot of people have asked me. You know, the guys from Vice were out, and I got some updates on Vice for you later on tonight. The guys from Vice were out, and they did this this filming. It's going to be, looks like, six parts airing around the 14th, I guess, or 15th. We'll see more. I don't have a ton of details. But they've always asked me, say, hey, man, if they did the big biopic of your life, you know, who would you want to play you, you know? And it's like, I have absolutely zero interest in that of any kind. Mainly for the reason that I couldn't stand the PTSD for reliving and retelling the story in as much detail as I would have to. I had to do that for Collapse. I'm not going to do that for anybody again. I don't have to go back there. But I could care less. But I had a kind of a funny dream this week. It's kind of following on our show from last week. And if there was to be a huge major biopic of the movie of my life, you know, starring some superstar, whatever, it would be called Eschaton. And in the dream, it was very clear that there would be no end credits. And I saw that, and that's kind of an inside Hollywood joke for all you Hollywood people out there. The movie of my life would be Eschaton. There would be no end credits. That leads me into, we're still trying to get a hold of Paul Beckwith, a great quote that comment that was made on my Facebook page from Hecate Kestel, and he writes, this is after last week's show where we talked a lot about Terrence McKenna. I still have nothing from the board on Paul, but he wrote, I can only imagine there is a great deal of gentleness in how one must treat oneself during such trying circumstances. I greet and bless you from that other hemisphere where we are not frozen, and I want you to know your show yesterday, this is about last week's show, was a blessing and a healing and a metaphysical hope, not hopium, about what is next. I deeply look forward to discovering more of what is here for us in Terrence's legacy. That was a very nice follow-up, and have been getting enormously good, I mean, and encouraging, solid, awake feedback about where we've been going with this from places I wanted to. I'm going to have to stop and communicate with the board. I have no indication that we have Paul on the phone. I have sent him okay, this is okay. We have achieved a loop here. I just sent him an email. All right. We are going to get him. We are going to get Paul Beckwith. There's too many questions we have. All right, everybody. I'm getting all these quotes on Facebook, and you're not hearing anything. That's not good. But we are trying to reach Paul. Everybody who's sending me to have the board call Paul. That's the way it started. We've been trying to do that. Please save your advice on that. We are now trying to have him call the studio. There is something interfering with the board's ability to reach Paul either at his landline or at his cell phone. So this is, you know, kind of a lot of drama. Now I feel like Vin Scully doing a Dodger game in Los Angeles. Great. I'm getting Facebook messages faster than I can count, and I do not have... We have Paul. We got him. Yay, woo-hoo. I knew that was going to happen. See, there was a little drama for us. Everybody can take a breath. All right, it's 13 minutes after the hour. Okay, we can pick up with this, and we can roll almost as if nothing happened. Paul Beckwith is a PhD.
Hello, how are you doing?
Hi, I haven't even introduced you yet, but I'm glad you're here, Paul.
Yeah, okay, I guess, I don't know whether the lines in your area are down or in my area, but anyway, go ahead, we're here now. So.
We got it through. Okay, let me just... intro you briefly. You are a PhD student. You are a part-time professor at University of Ottawa, but your specialty is in the geography department, abrupt climate change. Yes, and your areas of research are abrupt climate change, Arctic sea ice behavior, methane and carbon dioxide concentration, system feedbacks, regional geoengineering, climate change education and presentations, and social media. You are, in effect, the man for all seasons when it comes to what's going on with global warming. You are making a bridge for us. Now, I am aware that you have an active Facebook presence, and you have a big YouTube presence. Your videos are smash hits on my Facebook page and all over. But do you have a URL, and how can people find out more about what you're doing?
The best way is at the moment is just Google Paul Beckwith and climate change.
Okay.
I do a lot of blogs. I do blogs for Arctic News, which is Sam Karana's blog. I do blogs for the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. The acronym is AMEG, A-M-E-G. I also blog for the Sierra Club of Canada. So if you go to their main website and search for my name, I'm usually blogging once every month or two there. Also, there's other places that do pick me up, but those are the main sites. But usually, you know, Facebook and Twitter are the easiest ways to contact me, messaging me on Facebook or following my page, so on.
How many videos have you done so far?
It's a bit sporadic. I just bought a tripod for my iPhone, and so I'm starting to do a bit more now using that, and also so I don't know, on and off, I've probably done... I don't know, 15, 20, something
good,
like that. I don't know exactly, but
you're filling a huge need. Now, we are all aware, you know, almost all of us, whether we're in Australia where it's 130 Fahrenheit or, you know, or all over North America where we have had, in effect, and you'll clarify us on this, like a trap door open with a disintegrating jet stream that has released enormous amounts of cold air. Can you give us a quick update on the status of what is underway at present and when we might have a respite from it?
Okay, so I'll just talk for a couple minutes and just try to explain, you know, very simply to people what is going on. So we're emitting greenhouse gases, so they're warming the planet, but the planet doesn't warm evenly. The snow and ice, the sea ice cover and the snow cover in the northern region is melting very, very fast. Mm-hmm. So instead of reflecting 90% of the incoming solar radiation,
It's replaced by the ocean water underneath or the dark land, the permafrost, and that only reflects about 10% of the incoming light. It absorbs the rest, depending on whether it's dirt or whether it's seawater, you know, it absorbs the rest. So the north is heating up a lot more than it was before. So that decreases the temperature difference between the Arctic regions and the equator, and the temperature difference being smaller changes the nature of the jet streams which circle the Earth and guide weather patterns. So the jet streams are becoming much wavier, and storms are moving, so storms are tracking them and becoming wavier. So instead of there just being a north-south division between temperature, which changes with season, because the jet streams are very, very wavy, if you're above the jet stream, it's cold and dry. If you're below the jet stream, it's warm and moist. And those jets are moving, the waves are moving north in a north-south direction, mm-hmm. up to 1,500 kilometers or more. So the temperature can be very, very cold if it happens to drop below your latitude, or very, very warm if it's above. We're not really having a good temperature division between north and south as we used to. And what happened recently is because the jet stream got so wavy, a large chunk of it separated and came far south through the U.S., leading to that massive cooling spell. And that cold area was about 20 degrees Celsius, which is about 36 degrees Fahrenheit, colder than normal. And it went through the U.S., causing that deep freeze, causing all of those problems. But what people don't report on, I mean, the media called it the polar vortex, et cetera, got a lot of things right. But what is actually key that has not been discussed anywhere is that all that cold energy, cold air moving much more south than it would normally move is equivalent to that much warm air moving further north. So in other words, all that cold air came from the Arctic. It had to be replaced by something, which is warmer air.
Right.
So these large temperature swings, as the jet stream sort of cycles through, are causing a lot of mixing of the air. So we're losing the distinction between cold air in the Arctic and warmer air further
south. Okay, this is a question that I emailed you about, because it's been kind of obvious to me. This has been a very dramatic, let's call it, exchange of energy. And we know from the second law of thermodynamics that energy only converts in one direction. You know, efficiency, energy is lost. If this is a reciprocating engine, it's got to be getting weaker. And I correct me if I'm wrong, but is there not down the road at some point a stasis point where everything just kind of settles down? Isn't that where entropy goes?
Well, based on my research of the climate system, all the different elements, it appears to me our climate system right now is undergoing an abrupt transition from the state that we all know and are used to a much warmer state, which could be, if you believe the information in the paleo records, the climate of the system has increased 5 or 6 degrees or so in the space of a decade or two. In fact, it went up that much in 13 years in the paleo-Eocene thermal maximum time period. And there's been many other periods where it's climbed. The Greenland ice core records show it climbing 16 degrees Celsius in the space of about 10 or 20 years during the past. I mean, we've had many cyclings of temperature up and down. Mm-hmm. Humanity has been used to a stable climate, but I think we've kicked it out of that stability zone. I'm not saying that we couldn't bring it back, but fossil fuels the greenhouse, we've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere, and the Earth is responding, and it's responding a lot more quickly than people have believed or expected.
does conventional weather forecasting, meteorology, is it capable of building or forecasting on changes that are this rapid and unpredictable? What's the future of the weather forecasting here?
Okay, the model is used for weather forecasting and for climate forecasting are basically the same models but operating on different time scales. So for weather forecasting, you take all of the parameters of the weather, the temperatures, the precipitations, humidities, everything you know about the weather, you know, at a fixed point in time, mm-hmm. and then you use the equations of physics to propagate the system through time to give a prediction in 6 hours, 12 hours, et cetera. And that goes out about 7 days to 10 days. There's two main models that I look at, the GFSX one, which is the Global Forecast System. That's the U.S.-based model. And there's also the a European model, those are using different, they're different models, but they're basically using the equations to measure do the forecasting. And I found during the shoulder season, so during the fall and during the spring when we're changing seasons, I'm finding the models not as accurate. But during the winter and summer, they're generally more accurate.
This is of serious importance because, you know, humanity faces a multitude of crises, and we have a lot of things to do in order to survive. And one of those is permaculture. And permaculture is best described by my friend Debrag Dolman as thoughtful and protracted observation. Well, that implies some kind of climate stability upon which to build your food resources and everything else. And everything else, of course, changing that quickly. So what I'm getting at here is I think forecasting is going to become extremely important as things become more unstable just for the purpose of food.
Yes, I think, I think that I thought that the biggest sort of kick from the climate that would wake everybody up would be food shortages from extreme weather, from either drought destroying crops or excess rain flooding out fields, bringing down crops. But it appears to be that the acceleration of the extreme weather event, mostly the torrential rain, this particular cold spell, huge events. I mean, the torrential rain, of course, flooded out Calgary, Alberta, flooded out Toronto, flooded out Boulder, Colorado, and many, many other cities. I mean, we're talking about 6 months of rainfall in a day or two type events. And they're just pulling, it pulls apart infrastructure. I mean, we hear of pipeline leaks and breaks. You know, look at the weather for that week bracketing the event or the week ahead and see, you know, was there torrential rain there? Was parts of the area flooded? You know, the same with bridges and with train derailments. I mean, we've just had two in Canada. There was one in New Brunswick, and there was of an oil train, and there was a coal train in British Columbia, and then you've also had there was a couple in the U.S. also.
Yes, yes.
And the two in Canada, one was a broken axle, but it was when the temperature had swung from very, very warm because the jet stream was on the side, to very, very cold. And these temperature changes of maybe a temperature change from one day, it might be plus 10 degrees Celsius, which is, you know, which is like 40, 50 Fahrenheit, and then the next day it's well below freezing. So the rails will expand and contract. You know, when it gets really cold, they get brittler, they contract.
Yes.
The spaces between the attached rails, you know, they might be distorted on the ties, et cetera, and cause a derailment or a broken axle.
Many prices to be paid. We're down near the bottom of the hour, so give me a second here. Paul Beckwith, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This is a nightclub at the end of the world. We are going to roll without a commercial break at the bottom of the hour. I will do an ID now. It's Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth, on the Lifeboat Hour here on PRN-FM, January 12th, 2014, with Paul Beckwith. Now, of course, this is a nightclub at the end of the world, and I ask all my guests to pick a song because we mix in the hard energy, and it shows everybody a little bit more about what you're like. You picked the song, man. What was it? Tell us about it.
I picked Revolution by the Beatles. Just because, you know, I think we do need such a thing, a revolution in the way we do things in society and the way we deal with science and what scientists tell us.
All right, let's hear Revolution by the Beatles, Paul Beckwith's song here in the nightclub at the end of the world.
You want a revolution? Well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be alright? Alright. Alright. You say you got a real solution. Well, you know, love to see the plan. You ask me for a contribution. Well, you know, we all do what we can. But if you want money for people with minds that hate, all I can tell you is, brother, you have to wait. All right. All right. Institution. Well, you know, you better free your mind instead. But if you go carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, you ain't gonna make it with anyone anyhow. All right. All right.
Damn, that worked for me. That was the Beatles and Revolution. Thank you. thank you, Paul Beckwith. That was good timing. Okay, so one of the things that I was getting at, pardon me, there's a couple things I need to do too. This is part of station business, or just part of my business on the show. Give me a sec. Most of you know and that I do what I do here for love. I don't get paid for this show. I live on some Social Security and some small royalties from my books and the film, and I have enormous freedom this way. I'm not beholden to anyone. And you guys have been taking care of me. I have some thank yous and updates. Frank Damiano, Philip Sequeira, Stephanie Gogarn, and Linda Ackerman. I've written to many people this week. I just want to thank you for the small presents you've sent me and the gifts. I'm hanging in there. My Lincoln, if you follow the saga of my Lincoln, is holding up through the winter, but I've developed slow leaks and a couple of tires, so the tires are looming out there. I'm getting by. And this is all about love. This is not about anything else but that. If you like what I do, you can write to me, Michael Rupert, Tracker of Truth, or Rags, the dog, at 27378 Red Cloud Avenue, 27378 in Moffitt, M-O-F-F-A-T, Colorado, 81143. Or you can contact me on Facebook. I have PayPal information. We can do it that way. I'm hanging in there. It could be a lot worse. Utilities were... it cost $1,000 to keep from freezing this last month, but Doug's back. So we're getting by. So anyway, I needed to do that and say the thank yous. Thank you, Paul, for allowing me to do that. Now we're back with you. Where I was getting to an idea that I had that because this has been such a dramatic, noticeable thing for all of us gringos in North America and Turtle Island here this year, it's got our attention, but I tend to sense that these dramatic swings are going to have to start to diminish as we just reach a place of hot. Am I right on that?
I think that these, what I think is going to happen is that these dramatic changes are going to get far worse before they get far better.
Oh, dear. Okay.
I would expect that the... As the bellwether, if you like, the chink in the armor, the Achilles heel of the climate system, you know, look at the sea ice, what it's doing, okay? I mean, the sea ice is dropping exponentially. We had a record low in 2012, a bit of recovery this year. But if you look at the volume plot over time, it's trending to zero within 3 or 4 or 5 years or less. The U.S. Navy model shows it basically vanishing around the 2015-2016 timeframe. So when it does that, when and if it does that, then that will expose a very vast part of the ocean, which is presently covered by the ice. So the ice is reflecting energy from the sun. The ocean will absorb that energy. So we're going to have a ramping up of jet stream abnormalities and extreme weather events, and which will kind of reach a it'll ramp up. And I think it will ramp up at least an order, a factor of 10 or 20 in frequency of events, intensity of events, duration of events, spatial location on the Earth of where they're occurring.
We're talking orders of magnitude?
Well, an order of at least an order of magnitude, I would say, and that's based on the radiative forcing. It's based on the changes in the thermal behavior of the air and sea up in the Arctic when the ice does go. You know, and then the mixing of the cold and warm air will sort of be maximized, and then eventually, with the sea ice gone, like the first time it's gone, it would probably be for, you know, September, say 2015, 2016, and then within the next year, it would be gone probably for a longer duration time. Within about a decade, it could be gone year-round, and then we're in a much warmer climate system. The Arctic will not be as cold. And then perhaps the extremes of weather may kind of settle down. But one of the problems is when you warm the system, there's more evaporation. So since even in the last 30 or 40 years, with the 0.5 degree Celsius average global temperature rise, we have about 4 or 5% more water vapor in the atmosphere than we did 3 or 4 decades ago. And that water vapor, when it condenses, it releases energy, and it's fueling a lot of these huge storms that we're seeing.
It very
so it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better.
It very much sounds to me as similar to, you know, we've had Guy McPherson on the show a great many times. He's a dear friend, and I love his work. Talking about now 29, you know, it's probably 31 now, for all I know, multiply reinforcing positive feedback loops. And he describes an asymptotic process, and you are describing an asymptotic process that gets worse and worse and worse until some point at which what everything is, because it's hard to comprehend whether orders of magnitude and what we have seen around the world in the last year. I don't know how to get my head around
it. Yeah, this is a huge problem. This is a huge crisis for humanity. You know, and the Chinese define the word crisis as opportunity, right? So, I mean, the biggest thing that any individual person could do is to talk to their politicians, because the politicians just don't get it. I mean, they're getting all their input, or most of their input, from fossil fuel lobbyists and from big business lobbyists who want to maintain the status quo. So the biggest thing that any person could do is lobby their, you know, go and talk to your MP or senator or city, like whatever level, municipal, federal, state, you know, start talking to your representatives, your political representatives. And there's help to do this. There's a group called the Citizens Climate Lobby. CCL is the acronym. And there's bound to be people from this organization in your state or region or close by. And there's lots of tools from them on how to write letters to the editor, how to go lobby politicians, what the basic climate information is that you can bring to them and tell them. And they listen to their constituents. And this is a group that is growing in leaps and bounds. And they're proposing a fee and dividend on carbon. So there's a fee on it, so people use less of it, and any money raised from the collection of fees goes back as a dividend, a check to citizens. So it's not like an additional burden on people. But also there's a group, 350.org is really pushing on divestment of money from pension funds and things in fossil fuel companies. So, you know, if you're at a university, you can set up a group and go to the university and say, we don't want our endowment money invested in fossil fuel companies and so on. So there's things that people can do. And once you start doing something, you feel more empowered. You don't get down about all of these changes and things.
Doing something is absolutely, absolutely imperative. What's your take on geoengineering? I see that as one of your areas of research interest. What is your assessment of geoengineering as any kind of credible solution to do all of this, infinite growth? Take it, man.
Yeah. Okay. So I used to be completely against geoengineering. Okay. I thought we as a society had time to slash fossil fuel emissions, allowing the climate system to kind of, you know, reach what we're more used to, like stay in a state where we're. But over the last several years, it's been very clear to me that we've entered this abrupt climate situation where we're getting massive changes, and they're already affecting a lot of people, mostly through extreme weather events around the world. And I can tell you it's around the world. It's not just in the Northern Hemisphere. I can explain a bit why Australia is getting hammered and why the sea ice is actually growing in Antarctica. You know, I can relate those things. But basically, the
We were talking about geoengineering.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Geoengineering. So I'll try to stay more on topic there.
That's okay.
Okay.
This is heavy stuff we talk about here.
So I was totally against geoengineering, but because of the rate that climate is changing at,
I've changed my tune on that because there's so many feedbacks in the system which increase the rates of change. In fact, one of them that is very important that I'm very concerned about is methane emissions in the Arctic, both from the terrestrial permafrost, so permafrost under the ground, and also the permafrost on the ocean floor, specifically on the continental shelves around the Antarctic, around the Arctic, rather, and mostly the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf is a vast one.
These are methane hydrates?
Yes, there's methane hydrates, and the ocean floor, the water depth is only about 50 meters or so. These sediments this methane is in the sediments. It's either in the form of methane hydrates or as just permafrost, just organic matter, which when it's warmed, it decomposes and breaks and produces CO2 CH4 and methane. So the methane emissions from the Arctic have greatly increased over the last decade or so. There's still a small fraction of the methane overall that is emitted on the planet, but the overall global levels of methane are going up. And the problem with methane is that it has a much more potent effect on climate. It's a very powerful greenhouse gas, and on a very short time scale of a few years, you know, high elevated amounts of methane can significantly warm regions. And I think the methane coming up in the Arctic is at a high enough level to cause localized warming there. So we're seeing lots of temperature anomalies, regions that are 20 degrees Celsius, which is 36 Fahrenheit, warmer than normal.
That's Siberia right now, right?
Yeah, that's in and over the Arctic Ocean also. So this is a huge feedback effect. So I think because we're undergoing this abrupt change, we have a choice. We don't do anything, and we rock it up to a much warmer temperature with all that entails. Or I think there is still a chance to try to keep the sea ice in the Arctic and have the snow cover recover, and that would be through regional geoengineering, so trying to cool the Arctic region specifically, and we can do that by there's various methods proposed. I think the quickest and method that is sure to work would be sulfur dioxide seeding of the stratosphere. I call it the anthropogenic Arctic volcano. So if you just Google anthropogenic Arctic volcano, you can see my blog on that particular topic.
You can hear me.
If we cooled the Arctic with this method, we could restore some stability to the jet streams, recover some of what we had before in terms of a more stable climate, but we have to match this by slashing CO2 emissions. This is only a stopgap.
Thank you.
To give us more time to slash emissions.
So, but, you know, you are in a crowd in a nightclub tonight where we have very little hope of achieving the collective threshold change of consciousness to actually do that. You know, Guy McPherson has said unequivocally that the only thing that can prevent near-term extinction is an immediate cessation of all industrial activity, and even that wouldn't prevent. That's the one thing over which man has control. I don't see the will for to do that mustering. So we're still fighting a fallback war.
Okay, but the will, I would argue that there is a definite tipping point in human behavior, and you know, the will to do that could come extremely quickly after, say, a massive crop failure.
Good.
California is kind of like a breadbasket of the nation. Similar to the way the Ukraine is for Asia and Russia. And rainfall in California is about 20% of normal levels at the moment.
Yes.
If you check up on some of the – there could be massive crop failures in California, and people – like the rain is failing there, as it has been in other parts of the U.S. Southwest.
Yes.
Right? And, you know, because we're a global food system, you know, a complete failure in California while we import food from other places around the world. But what we've had is we've had, you know, in the last few years, we had grain crop failure in Russia, 40% drop in 2010 when they had their heat wave. We've had massive failures in, you know, Texas and regions, you know, different types
droughts,
of crops.
Yes.
In South America, we've had failures. China has had failures. The thing is, they haven't been synchronized, right? So the global food system, you know, prices go up, but there's still, you know, still availability. But, you know, when we get a synchronization, when the extreme weather events get bad enough and there's a synchronization of crop failure, then everybody will be paying double or triple for food if you get it, and that tends to
get people's attention,
change their view very quickly. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, we're down to the last 12 minutes. I want to play my song because it's kind of cool. I'm kind of excited to play my song now here in the nightclub at the end of the world. And what you kind of suggested, Paul, was that the world needs a bitch slap. And,
exactly.
And okay, but that offers some hope. The song I'm playing tonight for my song is one of my songs. It's a song I'm very proud to have written a lot of with Doug Lewis, my bandmate, in New White Trash. It's the opening song for this, and it's really kind of appropriate. I think it fits here because we are reaching for a miraculous change in consciousness, and energetically we are all expressing the fact that we believe it's available. Here's a song called Inner Reach. I'm singing the lead on this. This is New White Trash from our album Age of Authority. Haven't heard this in a while. Here we go.
All the street lights around me, in the wall-to-wall prison of my city, flickering dirty neon over alleys mean and dirty streets, while my neighborhood is torn down around me, too many people on the zombie streets, and the sirens make an eerie sound around me, makes me cold, makes me hot, makes me freeze. It's getting hard in the inner reach, ever strange beneath the streets, all around where all the light waves meet,
where all the light waves
and dance in secret. Kids with toys haunt the hallways, stuffing secrets up my sleeve, and the only country club around here is the cold cement under my feet. Most days I feel like a drowning man in a sea of drunken thieves, while this world goes on in a whirl around me. They speak, and it's getting hard in the inner reach, ever strange beneath the streets, all around where all the light waves meet,
where all the light waves meet and dance in secret,
turn into the age of authority, they enter into
the age of authority. When the explanations don't explain and the conclusions don't conclude, when answers don't answer and questions don't matter, and everything has gone so rude, Well, the stars incline, but don't insist that everything is done in a dancing twist. All around where all the light waves meet and dance, and dance. And it's getting hard in the inner reach, ever strange beneath the streets. All around where all the light waves meet,
where all the light waves meet and dance. It's secret.
Enter into the age of authority. They enter into the age of authority. They enter into the age of authority.
Yes, sir. That's New White Trash, the album Age of Authority. That was yours truly singing. You can find the song at newwhitetrash.com. Okay, we are back. Last 7 minutes of the hour. We do have a caller for Paul Beckwith with a question. Rose in Mount Shasta, are you there?
Hi, Rupert. I wanted to say thank you for all your great work. I just wanted to say that we're here in Siskiyou in Shasta County, and we've been working with the Geoengineering Watch people out of Shasta County, and we're getting off-the-chart levels of aluminum and barium, which matches the patent, the Welsbach patent. And what I'd like to ask your guest is, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm hearing the radio, too. I'll move away from it.
Yeah.
But what I'd like to ask your guest is, we have citizens from all around California and all around the world that are really picking up these geoengineering chemicals, and we've been doing this for 10 years, and I just wonder why. It seems like the academia totally ignores the fact that we see hundreds, multiple planes in the skies. It matches the patents. The chemicals that are coming off our snowpack.
We're short on time. You have to give him time to answer. So.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You're talking about chemtrails. When I was talking about geoengineering, it was from the point of view that I haven't seen conclusive evidence that chemtrails are being used. I don't know what to think about chemtrails. I'd love to see studies of soil chemistry. I'd love to see some studies of, some scientific evidence that it's occurring. Like I'm hoping maybe you can email me or post on Facebook some evidence that you're saying of high barium levels and aluminum levels that you're talking about. Like, is this being published, or do you have some lab results?
Yeah, I think it's been pretty well documented for a number of years that chemtrails do exist. I mean, come on,
right.
I see them all the time.
Well, what's the purpose of it? Is it to cool the planet? Is it to do something else? Like,
those are the answers that we're trying to get. What we are aware of is that they are occurring. I mean, I've got some good optics, and I have observed four jets being emitted from the horizontal stabilizer of commercial aircraft bodies flying overhead at 10,000-15,000 feet. You can't mistake this stuff.
Okay, so if it's like if they're doing it, like, okay, so if it's being done to cool climate, it's obviously not working. Right?
Yeah, thank you.
Like, if it's being done to generate rainfall somewhere, then that's, I know in China they try seeding the clouds to, before the Olympics, they tried seeding the clouds to make it rain outside of the city before the water clouds reached Beijing during the Olympics. I know that they, you know, other farmers and like people have used it to try to induce rainfall or make it rain elsewhere. Some of the theories on why chemtrails are being used is some people say it's like a control measure. There's something there to harm people or to change crops or whatever. I mean, I it's not my area. Like, it's not my, but there are people who are spending their lives studying geoengineering. Like, if they're doing it on a large scale, I mean, have people gone into airport? Couldn't you just go in and, like, photograph planes taking off and landing and get close-ups of the what's sending it out? I don't know.
No, these I know are commercial aircraft bodies, but they do not take off and land from commercial airports.
Yeah, I mean, what people do have to understand, too, is that they're, you know, normal plane engines, they put out a lot of chemicals in the exhaust, including water vapor. And depending on the atmospheric conditions, trails can come out just from the water vapor and then persist for long periods of time. So
those are called contrails. Yeah, my dad was an Air Force aviator, and I was explained the difference between contrails and deliberate chemical discharge at a number of Air Force bases when I was growing up. So this is, you know, I don't want to go into the debate because we only have 2 minutes left, and so we have to get some closure on this show. I think Rose made a good point. My concern would be this, and thank you for calling, Rose. We're in the last minute. Would be this. Albert Einstein said very clearly that you cannot solve a problem at the same state of consciousness that created the problem. You know, I look at tar sands is a techno fix. Shale oil is a techno fix. Fracking is a techno fix. And they have not done well or augured well for the web of life or the environment that we live in. I am concerned that geoengineering and nuclear energy was a techno fix for a shortage of, I mean, you know, so mankind doesn't have a great record with techno fixes. What I'm hearing now is a sense of, and we're in the last minute, I'm going to give you the last 30 seconds or so, Paul. Is that if we are down to these truly desperate measures to try to address a 4 to 6 degree centigrade global increase in temperature, which is scientifically assured by a bazillion and a half peer-reviewed studies, we are really in desperate situations, are we not? And we'll have to sign off after you get the last word here.
I would say that we're in a very desperate situation, and it's very frustrating to the science community that they've been saying climate change is a problem for years, but their voices have been drowned out by large and powerful voices that have lots of dollars but no sense.
And that's the runaway train that appears to be out of control on so many fronts. Paul, you're amazingly useful to us because when I see you put up something, you are blindly, if you will, and I don't mean that you're blind, but you are helping us to fill in like blind men stumbling through a room what we can look forward to with the increasing instability that's out there. Grateful for you. Grateful that you joined us tonight on the Lifeboat Hour. Thank you so much, man.
Anytime. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, everybody. Tracker Truth, Michael C. Rupert. We're coming back with Carolyn Baker next week. I need to chill out and reorganize here, baby. But hang in there. We are doing this 1 week at a time. I love you guys. See you next week. Good night.